From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to the Friday edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for FRC Action, and it is my privilege to be sitting in for Tony today. Well, I call this our American Heroes edition. These are individuals we'll talk to today, five of them specifically, who show that standing up to truth is never easy, but always right. The outrage among California parents over the new extreme sex ed curriculum is palpable. I'll talk to Kira Davis first, who attended a school board hearing this past Monday in Santa Ana, California, and will tell us about what she saw. Then I'll chat with Shonda Lois. She is one of the enraged parents who is trying to slow this runaway train down in Anaheim in the not-so-golden state. In my second segment, I'll talk to the CBN News reporter who was attacked and nearly kidnapped on the Venezuelan border with Colombia by three thugs sent from dictator Nicolas Maduro. At the bottom of the hour, we'll talk about New Mexico's extreme abortion bill that failed to pass, unbelievably, the Democratic majority state Senate yesterday. This was thanks in part to my guest, Pastor Jay McCollum, who rallied the New Mexican pro-lifers to ensure the bill did not pass. And at 42 past the hour, I'll have the amazing story of Jamie Shoup. He first declared that he was a woman living in a man's body and identified as such, and then he was declared by a court to be the first non-binary person in America. And now, as of January 25th of this year, Jamie has gone back to embracing his masculinity and says that the entire transgender movement is a sham. Jamie joins me for what will be a fascinating discussion. As a reminder, you can visit the podcast for today's broadcast and find out more information about my guests, TonyPerkins.com. You can follow Tony on Twitter, at TPerkins, and me, if you'd like, at Sarah P. Perry. Well, on Monday night in Santa Ana, California, parents were speaking out at the school board meeting about the radical sex ed curriculum being pushed through public schools after passage of the 2016 California Healthy Youth Act. The proposed California health ed framework is what is being pushed through all of these schools, and it is about this curriculum that these parents rallied in Anaheim. My first guest is one of those parents. Kira Davis also happens to be a journalist and co-host of the Smart Girl Politics podcast, a fan I am, who wrote a townhall.com column detailing exactly what happened. Kira, thanks for being here. Welcome to Washington Watch.
Sarah, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So Monday night's school board meeting was heavily attended by concerned and frightened parents. And this is in a district particularly that has a heavy Hispanic population concentration. These parents were confused and upset, but exactly what did you see in terms of numbers of turnout?
Well, it was a really good turnout. I had actually, this is not my school district. My own school district is a little bit south of theirs, but I got wind of the meeting and heard that there would be a rally of parents there. So I wanted to see how many parents were attending and what their treatment would be by the school board. When I got there, the place was full. I mean, people were waiting anxiously for their opportunity to speak. They filled out their comment cards, got in line, so to speak. They were really anxious and fired up. A lot of them are only just hearing now for the first time that this curriculum is coming down, even though it got approved in 2016. So the California State Department of Education has been purposely deceptive in handing down this information and disseminating it. And I knew that they had been particularly deceptive in disseminating it in Hispanic communities. The state has an obligation to provide any curriculum materials up for a vote in both Spanish and English so that Hispanic-speaking parents and from the immigrant community in particular can review the curriculum just like English-speaking parents can. They did not do that. They provided the final approval in Spanish, but they never gave Spanish-speaking parents this opportunity. So they were really fired up. They were more concerned about their rights as parents and the right to reserve these types of conversations for home, the right to refuse public school to be educating their children in some of these more sexually explicit aspects of the curriculum. And I will say this, that their treatment was, I thought they were very much condescended to. They were purposefully delayed. They delayed the meeting. They delayed the remarks. And then they cut the time the parents were allowed to respond from 3 minutes to just 1 minute apiece. So shenanigans all around. Yeah.
And if I read correctly, the school board actually employed some delay tactics in terms of pushing the meetings beginning off by about 45 minutes and then actually having 45 minutes and then the board president reading painfully slowly and actually repeating herself from an information packet on administrative procedures in the district. Is that right?
Yeah, well, she was actually highlighting some other things that were going on in the district, legitimate stuff, but nothing that was on the agenda. And I watched her pull up this paper. It was 5 pages easily, and she'd read each paragraph and then pause to make her own comments. And then before the parent comment period was allowed, she actually stopped to scold the parents that were there. That I thought that was quite insulting. So she made sure that everyone knew that that they were misinformed, ill-informed, and they didn't know what they were talking about, and that their comments basically were not going to be welcome.
What were some of the comments that you were hearing from the parents when they got up to speak at the meeting?
Most of the parents were concerned about their rights to approve the material before the children saw it. One parent in particular stood up and said, you know, this stuff is already happening, and I'm not being notified of any of it. There was an LGBT fair at her school. She didn't know that it was happening at her daughter's school until afterwards. Mm. And her daughter told her that at the fair, they had employed a local drag performer, a drag queen performer, to come in and offer makeup lessons. Now, this is middle school. And so the mother said, I don't take the sexuality aspect out of it. I don't think anyone should be teaching my child how to apply makeup,
right,
you know, in 7th, 8th, 9th grade.
So we also learned that 4 out of 5 of the pro-curriculum commenters didn't live in the Santa Ana district, correct?
Yeah, Sarah, we're seeing this a lot here across the state, not just in the Santa Ana district the other night, but it's happening all over. What's happening is the activist groups that have pushed, that have conspired with the State Department of Education to push these curriculum standards forth without parent consultation, they are sending out their operatives out to these school board meetings, and they're hogging up parent comment time. So we followed a group of commenters out of the room after they spoke their piece. And by the way, they were rude and condescending. This group was 99% Hispanic, the group of parents. And a white woman stood up and told them that they called them liars, called them fearmongers, called them hate mongers, and then left. And we followed her out only to find out that she and 3 of the other people who had come with her to comment did not even live in Santa Ana.
Oh, Kira, thank you for joining me today. I'm going to hop over. I want to be joined now by Shonda Lobatos, and she lives in Anaheim. This is her school district. She actually took it upon herself to be a mother warrior. This is a woman who I automatically have so much respect for. I am also a mom, and boy, I hope I have her courage one day. Shonda, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so we have a lot of ground to cover in about 5 minutes here, but I want to know, you are now in Anaheim. You have children in the public school system. How did you discover, and your particular avenue into the issue of sexuality in public schools in California was through a diversity week. Is that right?
Yes. So I believe it was April 27th in 2018, they sent home a flyer to the parents. And what it said was that they were going to have a diversity week that was going to be put on by the Anaheim Elementary School District, Western Youth Services, and the LGBT Center of OC. At that point, I was really concerned because to me that looked like they had already put together some type of program that they haven't notified the parents. So I immediately sent out an email to the principal that Friday evening. And on Monday morning, I went into the school and spoke to the principal, And what she said was that they were going to have a diversity week, and it's been put on hold because a lot of parents were complaining. Now, when I sat down to speak with her and I was with another parent, I asked, I said, okay, is this part of AB 329? Is this part of SB 48? And she said, no, that hasn't been implemented. So from that point, I went on to the vice superintendent, and I engaged with her to find out what was going on. There was a lot of runaround. They said that under Title IX, they were going to bring in this diversity week, and it was because there was one or two transgenders within the community or within the community of the school that did not feel welcome, so they brought in the diversity week. I started to notice safe zone signs around the school, and at the bottom of the safe zone sign, it said LGBT Agency of OC. I went back and asked them, why is this agency on a elementary school district campus and having safe zones with the rainbow, which we know that gender spectrum comes from Alfred Kinsey, and we know that his studies are very concerning. They would not give me too much information except where they received training at Fullerton College and that they were supporting a student. At that point, I ordered a FOIA, started going through the FOIA, and realized that in September of the year prior, they had updated a board policy, 5145.3, under harassment. And at the bottom of the page, it had different reference sources, but it was connected to a board meeting. So I went back to the board meeting meeting notes and found that they created an LGBT committee, which we didn't know anything about. Violation of Educational Code 220. That's a huge problem. Started to get the FOIAs to come in, realized that they created this committee that was ran by the librarian, and they had very set outlines of what they were going to teach the children, which included having someone from the LGBT center come in, read Jacob's Dress, as well as they were talking about challenging the children's constructs of gender. Now, because my background is a master in psychology, challenging their foundational construct and appealing to their empathy through safe zones to change an outward behavior is part of Dr. Bloom's taxonomy of education. So now they're implementing more of a cognitive behavior modification program. And when you bring in that AB 329, which is extremely graphic, which we had an incident in Anaheim Union with parents, you're looking at a long-term program from K through 12. So once I received the FOIA, and I knew that this was a concern, I contacted Mass Resistance, and I started working with Arthur from the Southern California District, who helped me combat with the board members about what they were bringing in based upon the FOIA.
Shonda, I am so pleased that we've had a chance to talk. We have more to talk about. I want to have you back on Washington Watch. Keep doing what you're doing. We know that this bias curriculum is a product of, among other organizations, the Human Rights Campaign, and that your FOIAs revealed not only hostility toward the parents, but the fact that these educators, these administrators, believed that they were going to be really on the cutting edge of Title IX and gender identity in public education. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Sarah Perry. Coming up next, I will talk to the CBN News reporter who was attacked on the border between Venezuela and Colombia by three thugs. We will hear his incredible story next.
Picture it. Majestic beauty all around you. Wildlife, deep blue waters, glacial mountains, lush forests. Can you imagine the majesty of creation at every turn? Discover Alaska with FRC. You'll enjoy every moment of this unforgettable experience. Juno, accessible only by sea and air. Ketchikan and its impressive collection of Native American totem poles. Glacier Bay, a breathtaking wonder. All this, plus a behind-the-scenes look at what Family Research Council is doing in our nation's capital. You'll hear directly from FRC President Tony Perkins, General Jerry Boykin, and Michelle Bachmann. This is no ordinary vacation. You'll be vacationing with the FRC family and a lot of new friends. Be rejuvenated as we deepen our relationships with God and each other. Don't just get away with purpose on Family Research Council's Alaska Cruise, July 7th through 14th. Call 844-872-5155 to register today or visit us online at frc.org/Alaska.
In recent news, we've seen the left's disregard for life. They've gone beyond defending abortion to now defending infanticide. We've seen the push for legislation in New York, Vermont, and Virginia that would allow abortion even on a baby's birthday. And if an abortion fails, to withhold medical care from the baby born alive, causing him or her to die. This is infanticide. In the left's most recent act of disregard toward human life, we saw each Democratic senator running for president vote against a bill that would protect babies born alive. Help us end birthday abortion. On the day of a baby's birth, the first article placed on the baby is a thermal hat with blue and pink stripes. That's our hope for every baby. But there are no federal laws in place to protect all babies born alive from being killed outside the womb. To show your support for the life of all babies born alive, visit endbirthdayabortion.com. For a donation of $9, we'll deliver one baby hat on your behalf to U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to send a powerful reminder that babies should be welcomed with warmth.
The world on our horizon isn't like the days I knew. Gone are the days of writing with fresh ink on thick paper and the swift crack of a letter opener. Homemade meals now replaced by fancy robots trying to figure out how often I buy organic goji berries. I don't even know what a goji berry is. My church started offering free Wi-Fi and changed their name from First Baptist to Radiant Water Life something or other. They even started posting video sermons recorded on wood pallet backgrounds that sync directly to a Dropbox that I have yet to locate. Thankfully, there's a silver lining to all this newfangled technology. Family Research Council's Stand Firm app. Put down your quill and contact your legislators directly from your smartphone or tablet. Share legislative alerts with your contacts and connect with like-minded Christians about the latest current events. Read the Washington Update and listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. This thing's got it all, buddy boy. Keep your cool and help secure our future at frc.org/app.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for FRC Action, and your host today. Well, the lights are starting to come back on in Caracas and in parts of Venezuela, but the extended power outage and ongoing food crisis have sent a tidal wave of humanity fleeing the country to neighboring Brazil and Colombia. And for those of you who, like me, have a tendency to be news junkies, there is no shortage of footage of the disastrous regime under Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro. His thugs are now targeting people every day for robbery and kidnapping on the town of Cucuta, which is the border town between Venezuela and Colombia. And one of those victims is going to be my next guest today. He is a reporter with CBN News, and his name is Chuck Holton. Chuck, are you there? Now, before we go to Chuck, I do want to talk a little bit about the fact that we've seen socialism at work in Venezuela. The Economist cover just this month was the fact that millennials have indicated a 51% preference for socialism over capitalism. So despite Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, discussion of Bernie Sanders, the talk of a Green New Deal, we've seen in the past 2 weeks the Venezuelan troops literally burn aid shipments from the United States and other countries. So if that doesn't give you, as a listener, every cause for the anxiety of socialism and the insanity of dictator Nicolas Maduro, I don't know what would. So, Chuck, welcome to Washington Watch.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
The border between Venezuela and Colombia is now officially closed. The bridge that had tens of thousands of people crossing it when you were there 2 weeks ago is now essentially empty. So tell me about this bridge and what you experienced when you were there.
Okay, so when I was here 2 weeks ago, the bridge was absolutely packed with people crossing from Venezuela into Colombia to make purchases because there is no food, there is no medicine, there is no toilet paper or anything in Venezuela. And at that time, everybody was making their purchases and crossing the bridge back into Venezuela. Once that fiasco happened 2 weeks ago with the aid, when I'm trying to take the aid into Venezuela, the Venezuelan troops burned the aid trucks on the bridge and blocked the bridge from any passage. And then Maduro closed the entire border. So once that happened, now people are crossing the river instead of the bridge. They are just within sight of the bridge. I was just standing out there a moment ago. And there's just an unbroken conga line of people crossing the river. The problem with that is that it's extremely dangerous. There are the river is controlled by those colectivos, the gangs loyal to Maduro, and they have permission from the Maduro regime to rob and even kill the people who are coming across there. So they stand there and watch everybody who comes across, anybody who brings anything they want, they take. Everybody else, they charge a fee to get across.
So as you were filming along the riverbank, you were attacked by three men. And I want to know what it was about these men that tagged you sort of in your mind as to the fact that these might be thugs hired by Maduro.
Well, we didn't find that out until afterwards. I was down there filming. I kind of knew better than to go right down onto the riverbank. But I was trying to get a better shot of the empty bridge back behind me. And so I thought I could step with all the people around. I figured, who's going to bother me with thousands of people around?
Sure.
And I stepped down there, and they kind of circled behind me. You can see it on the video later. I didn't notice because I was focused on my camera. But they circled behind me. They came up and grabbed me. Now, they didn't try to rob me. They didn't try to hurt me. They tried to grab me. One grabbed my belt from behind. The other one grabbed my arm. And when I realized that they were literally carrying me into Venezuela, pulling me across into Venezuela, then I knew it was go time. And I just said, I mean, there was no way I was going to end up in Venezuela that night. And so I had a GoPro on a selfie stick. I whacked one guy over the head, and then I ran off. We found out after that, the local people told us, you should watch out for those guys because they work for Maduro.
So you, as a former Army Ranger, and thank you for your service to our nation. Did you feel that training kick in? And is this a unique situation in terms of the level of hostility and government unrest in comparison to anything you've experienced?
Well, first of all, let me just say it makes me very uncomfortable when people kind of compare this to something Chuck Norris would do or anything like that. The bottom line is,
those of us who haven't done it.
I've been working as a war correspondent for 15 years, and the bottom line is I should know better. And it was my fault. I went down there. I went against my better judgment. I didn't listen to that voice in the back of my head that told me I shouldn't do that and shouldn't carry my big, expensive cameras down there. But I did it anyway, and it's because I got complacent that they had the opportunity to attack me. Now, with that said, I have kind of worked that out ahead of time in my brain. One of the things that, the military does teach you is that when it's go time, you got to go 100%. Speed, surprise, and violence of action. And I think that did very likely come in handy. And I think it surprised those guys because they were kind of expecting, maybe somebody from CNN or something that would have just rolled over and given them their cameras and run away.
Well, I have to say, for someone who has never experienced both active service and war correspondence, you are a real-life Chuck Norris to us. Before you go, I want to pray quickly for your safety, Chuck. Lord, we ask in Jesus' name that you would keep your protective hand over Chuck as he's out in the field reporting on some of the most volatile political situations in the world, that you would bless his continued work and his search for the truth and keep him safely in your loving arms. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Chuck Colton has been my guest. He is a CBN reporter. You are listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, abortion is again on the agenda. New Mexico's extreme abortion bill failed to pass the Democratic majority state Senate. Yes, you heard that right. Thanks in part to my next guest, Pastor Jay McCollum. He was able to rally New Mexican pro-lifers and change the course of history. We'll be talking to him right after this.
Myth and folklore have influenced our civilization for centuries. Some of these myths can be wondrous tales of fantasy that inspire us from childhood, such as unicorns and the ever-beloved elf on a shelf. Others, however, can be detrimental to our well-being, from the Loch Ness Monster to big tax refunds. Today, the myths surrounding abortion have become part of such vexations that plague our society. Since 1973, these abortion myths have grown a substantial foothold in developing a climate of fear, misinformation, and a culture of death in the United States. In FRC's new analysis, learn whether most Americans support abortion on demand, and if a fetus does in fact feel pain in the womb. Join us as we debunk these myths and find the truth to secure a future for the culture of life. Visit frc.org/myths.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm your host today, Sarah Perry, FRC Action's Director of Partnerships. Well, yesterday in the New Mexico Senate, history was made. It had been a tough fight for pro-life advocates after HB 51 passed the New Mexico House in February, and Democratic Governor Michelle Grisham, who claims to be a Catholic, said she was prepared to sign the radical pro-abortion bill into law. But it was not until it made it to the Senate that the brakes were hit. After hearing from pro-lifers across the state by email, by phone, and in person, senators did indeed reject HB 51, the radical pro-abortion bill that would have kept abortions legal for any reason, at any time, up to birth in the state of New Mexico. Pastor Jay McCollum of First Baptist Church of Gallup, New Mexico, was a key pastor who led the fight against this devastating pro-abortion bill, but its exhilarating success. Pastor McCollum, welcome to Washington Watch.
It's a pleasure to be with you this Friday afternoon.
Pastor, I have to tell you, on behalf of myself and Tony, we both believe you are truly a hero and to be thanked for your incredible and impressive efforts in rallying the grassroots in this cause. But you knew that the odds were stacked against you, that every Republican, if you could be sure, would vote against HB 51. But there are also 24 Democratic senators. What was your tactic going in to trying to make sure that this did not pass in the House or in the Senate?
Well, first, let me state to all those who are listening this afternoon, this was a grassroots effort with many players. I'm just one of many who targeted constituents all across the state of New Mexico. We've had multiple people going to Santa Fe, visiting with their representatives, senators. We have visited with them on a personal matter in their offices. We have gone to committee meeting hearings. We have sent emails. We have sent phone calls. We have sent text messages. There have been many proactive groups, Catholic Church with the work of the bishops and Archbishop of New Mexico, went in, had a prayer gathering and a candlelight vigil at the roundhouse here in Santa Fe. And then we've had different meetings challenging committee members with excellent testimony. And I can't underestimate the importance of prayer. All across our state, we have been having prayer groups, prayer meetings, churches stopping in their worship services to pray, to move the heart of House of Representatives, which we had six move over, but quite enough to kill it in the House. And then in the Senate, we were just praying that God would touch the hearts of the senators after making all this tremendous push. And we were victorious last evening, which we're celebrating because the sanctity of life and the precious baby being born is a great gift from God.
Amen to that. Now, you decided, among some of these other grassroots organizations, to target 10 Democratic senators out of the 24 to plead specifically the case of these babies. And there were other organizations, the Family Policy Alliance, I know, for example, New Mexico Alliance for Life, a number of churches in the area, all coming together to decide that they were going to target these 10 senators. What was the messaging to those senators, people who you had every reason to believe would vote along party lines in making sure that HB 51 was passed into law? What was your message to them?
Well, you know, first of all, this is a life. It is a bona fide life. And when you start looking at a baby in the womb that can live outside his mother's womb, that is a precious life. And we pushed hard at this. And then, you know, looking at the fact that there were those who were saying that a baby born up to its actual birth date, the last moment, and would be an botched abortion, would be alive, don't we have a moral responsibility to try to save that life? And many nurses and doctors were joined in with us and saying that we have to do everything possible to save a life of a child. Mm-hmm. We do that for every human being. And of course, we had an argument on the floor of the Senate last evening, led by a Democrat, talking about, you know, if we're going to save prairie dogs and kittens, and a human life more valuable. And I think all of that moved the heart of these key senators in this vote. You know, there are many people who are God-honoring, God-fearing people who serve in legislatures all across our nation. And many of them are common sense and people who value life, and we had to appeal to their heart. And that was a God thing. That's all. God receives the glory in this, and the work that we did was a group effort. I cannot take the full credit for this and will not.
Pastor McCullough, we are so grateful to you for the efforts of everything that your organization did, that your church did, for the grassroots efforts, the 22,000 petition signatures that made it to the New Mexico. We understand this is a bill that would have even repealed conscience protection. So not only up until the moment of birth, but the inability to say my faith as a Christian prevents me from participating. Pastor, thanks so much for being with us. You are listening to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Well, coming up next, I have an amazing story. He declared he was a woman and identified as a transgender woman, then was determined to be the first non-binary person in America, and now, as of January this year, he has embraced his masculinity and says the whole movement is a sham. Jamie Shoup joins me next on Washington Watch.
Picture it. Majestic beauty all around you. Wildlife, deep blue waters, glacial mountains, lush forests. Can you imagine the majesty of creation at every turn? Discover Alaska with FRC. You'll enjoy every moment of this unforgettable experience. Juno, accessible only by sea and air. Ketchikan and its impressive collection of Native American totem poles. Glacier Bay, a breathtaking wonder. All this, plus a behind-the-scenes look at what Family Research Council is doing in our nation's capital. You'll hear directly from FRC President Tony Perkins, General Jerry Boykin, and Michelle Bachmann. This is no ordinary vacation. You'll be vacationing with the FRC family and a lot of new friends. Be rejuvenated as we deepen our relationships with God and each other. Don't just get away. Get away with purpose on Family Research Council's Alaska Cruise, July 7th through 14th. Call 844-872-5155 to register today or visit us online at frc.org/Alaska.
In recent news, we've seen the left's disregard for life. They've gone beyond defending abortion to now defending infanticide. We've seen the push for legislation in New York, Vermont, and Virginia that would allow abortion even on a baby's birthday. And if an abortion fails, to withhold medical care from the baby born alive, causing him or her to die. This is infanticide. In the left's most recent act of disregard toward human life, we saw each Democratic senator running for president vote against a bill that would protect babies born alive. Help us end birthday abortion. On the day of a baby's birth, the first article placed on the baby is a thermal hat with blue and pink stripes. That's our hope for every baby. But there are no federal laws in place to protect all babies born alive from being killed outside the womb. To show your support for the life of all babies born alive, visit endbirthdayabortion.com. For a donation of $9, we'll deliver one baby hat on your behalf to U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to send a powerful reminder that babies should be welcomed with warmth.
Myth and folklore have influenced our civilization for centuries. Some of these myths can be wondrous tales of fantasy, from unicorns to the ever-beloved elf on a shelf. Others, however, can be detrimental to our well-being. Today, the myths surrounding abortion have become part of such vexations that plague our society. In FRC's analysis, 10 Myths on Abortion, join us as we debunk these myths and find the truth to secure a future for the culture of life. Visit frc.org/myths.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to our other free resources, go to frc.org/connect.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, sitting in for Tony today. Jamie Shoup's story has taken America by storm. I like to call this the op-ed heard round the world. In the Daily Signal, just a few weeks ago, Jamie published a story of how he declared in 2013 that he was a woman and identified as a transgender woman. Subsequently, he was declared by a court to be the first non-binary person in America. And as of now, Jamie's embraced his masculinity and says, in fact, the whole thing was a sham. His former transgender colleagues and advocates have been suspiciously silent since his final declaration, and he embraces the gender that God created him to be. So I am particularly excited to talk to him today. Jamie, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, before I delve into the specifics of your story, I want to commend you. I said at the beginning that this was our American Heroes edition, and truly, I wanted to end with you because your courage in making a statement that has become unpopular in modern day America requires such bravery and such commitment to the notion of unyielding biological scientific truth that you are truly someone that we here believe is a hero. So thank you on behalf of everyone here at FRC and on behalf of many who I know are grateful Americans as well. So I want to start with your decision to live as a woman, which you announced in the New York Times 4 years ago. Not exactly a small way to announce it. It was a very publicized op-ed at the time. How did you get to that place in 2013?
The truth behind it is I went through a massive mental health crisis in 2011 and 2012. And just the same way that these kids are now researching things on the internet, I did a bunch of Google searches and I ended up in transgenderism. And it promised me better mental health. And it seemed to fit what was wrong with me. So I said, just like one of these children, I latched onto it.
Hoping that this different identity would sort of patch over the parts of you that you felt were somehow broken or lacking in a way. Did you have a history of abuse in your background individually? Did you have aspects of your life, particularly because I know you as well have served in the United States Army, and thank you for your service. Were there experiences that you had prior to this that you believe may have been contributing to your internal unhappiness, your dissatisfaction with the way things were?
Very much so. As a child, I was sexually abused by a male relative, and that really set the stage for me to develop PTSD later in life.
Now, we obviously know that there is a situation widely discussed now after four court cases. I'm curious as to your individual perspective on this. As somebody who has been on both sides of the fence and who has themselves served in the United States military, what is your perspective on the fact that President Trump has instituted a ban on active service for individuals wanting to change their gender?
Well, we have to put this in the correct light, because the president truly hasn't banned transgender military service. What the president has done is he has banned the most toxic element of transgenderism, which he's placed a ban on gender dysphoria. That is the most toxic element, and I very much support the president on doing that.
So gender dysphoria, and we've talked about this a little bit before, but we could have listeners who don't understand that. Gender dysphoria, how is that different from simply identifying as transgender?
Gender dysphoria is when you essentially, that's the folks who believe they're born in the wrong body. And they want a crash course of basically, I mean, it's harsh words, but you're essentially mutilating yourself.
You took estrogen for 6 years. So after this op-ed, your impulse, okay, I've decided that I am truly a woman living in a man's body. I need to do something to rectify this. I need to take active steps. And you found a doctor, a clinic that was willing to prescribe you medication. Was that a hard sell to get that medication?
No, that was part of the, when I originally started hormones, again, that was part of my original mental health crisis. I literally looked up a nurse practitioner on the internet and made it. She had a mental health practice. I had made an appointment. I showed up armed with a document that I had printed out from a VA hospital that listed like the hormones to what I thought would turn me into a woman. I showed up at her office and I literally threatened her that if she didn't give me the hormones that day, I would buy them off the internet. Mm. And she should have put me in the psych ward, but she gave me the hormones.
So now after 6 years on being of estrogen, what are the physical manifestations of that? And what health side effects have you suffered? Because I can't imagine that flooding your body with a cross-sex hormone after living as a male for so long, after being a biological male, after having male hormones, the flooding of that estrogen, what did that do to your body?
It's really wreaked havoc on it. The problems started to show up when I started getting problems in the veins in my legs. And that, put me in the emergency room twice. At that point, we started figuring out that I was also developing problems with my kidneys. I've had skin problems. And the VA was so negligent in my care. As a female, my estrogen levels were supposed to have been 200. At one point, the Veterans Administration had my estrogen levels at 2,585. I was popping blood vessels in my eye and didn't understand why. Yeah, and eventually I ended up, I had two stays in the psychiatric ward because I was so destabilized. And then even 2 months after that, I was required another 2 weeks of psychiatric daycare, which cost the taxpayers $30,000.
Oh, so here we are, the first stage in your journey, and you've sort of found the entree through the medical establishment. You've gotten what you wanted, which is estrogen, these female hormones. Do you feel at this stage that the medical establishment had failed you, that maybe if you had hit a brick wall of sorts, that that would have changed the trajectory of your journey going forward?
Absolutely, it would have changed the trajectory. It would have put an end to it at the very beginning, because what I needed was mental health help. I needed somebody to really sit down, unpack my issues, debunk the things I thought about myself that were incorrect, and then help me from there. Instead, everybody just affirmed me the entire way. They blessed off and said, "Yes, you're a woman. you know, when I didn't think I was a woman anymore, they said, yes, you're non-binary. You're a combination of male and female. The whole way, everybody just helped pardon me instead of helping me.
Hmm. At any point, did anyone question therapy for you? Did anyone suggest mental health counseling or maybe psychiatric medications as opposed to just launching whole cloth into this treatment with cross-sex hormones?
Actually, what it did to me was so bad. Once they put that label on me of being a woman, it stressed me out so bad that they had to give me psych medications to keep me under control. I was either the entire time I was either on psychiatric medications or I was in medical marijuana program in Oregon just to try to even remotely stay stable. So again, this didn't help me at all. And you know, a further problem, you know, talking about therapists, you know, the therapists have been so beat up with these conversion therapy laws. I mean, the ones I had, they basically sat there and said, yes, you're a woman every time I showed up for my appointments. And they did that the whole time during the appointment.
I'm so glad that you brought that up because we understand that that is really sort of on the landscape. So we have seen originally the rash of conversion therapy bans, that first waft of litigation that comes through on a state basis. And now we're seeing conversion therapy bans for individuals who identify as transgender. And what it's doing is effectively muzzling medical professionals from being able to say, let's identify the root cause of your dissatisfaction. And I will tell you, as a mother of three kids, the oldest of whom has Asperger's, he's on the autism spectrum, between 30 and 70% of the teenagers, the middle school and teenagers that identify as being transgender actually have an underlying mental health or developmental diagnosis like autism. So my heart so connects with you on this, Jamie. I have to say, as a huge fan for breaking these stigmas surrounding mental health, whether it is in the conservative community or the liberal community, what I so wish we could rewind the clock and see happen is that a therapist or a psychiatrist had sat you down and said, let's identify where in your heart it hurts. So let's take us to the next phase. So now you decide you're dissatisfied with your identity as a transgender woman. Now you go through the process of being identified as non-binary. Can you tell me a little bit about that part of the story?
That occurred in late 2015 when basically my transition to a female fell apart. I realized that I wasn't a female. I had come to realize that I had done this for all the wrong reasons. And then I had the terrible problem of how to get myself out of this mess. And again, I was still delusional on these ideologies about, okay, well, if I have a male body and I have a female gender identity, then maybe that makes me an intersex person. And that's kind of the mindset I went into the non-binary thing with. But again, you know, there were failures in my care that should have stopped this, because the same doctor at the Veterans Administration who wrote my sex change letter to non-binary that I took to court, I had asked her before the court case to genetically test me. I wanted to know. I was like, am I a male? Because I would have accepted my birth sex and went back at that point. And the doctor actually told me the knowledge would harm me.
So you take it to court, you have this letter in front of your hand, and you receive a court order recognizing your brand new identity as being non-binary. Now, again, because we're dealing with 50 cent words and not all of us are conversant in sort of sexual identity politics, non-binary, this is sort of a catch-all, right, for all of the gender identities that aren't exclusively masculine or feminine, those that would fall outside what's frequently called the gender binary or cis normativity. Okay, so cisgendered, single gendered, that would be male, female. Not a phrase I believed 20 years ago I'd ever have to use in public conversation over the airwaves, but it is something outside a traditional male and female identity. So really, it was sort of that everything else. So when you get up in your everyday life, and now you've got this new identity as a non-binary person, you have two forms of identity. What does your heart feel? How are you feeling internally now that you've won what has for many transgender activists been this hallmark ruling, this creation of a new identity? Now we know, obviously, in some states you can mark X as your gender identity on driver's licenses as an indication that you are genderqueer or non-binary, falling outside that norm. How do you feel now that you've gotten this court order indicating that you are non-binary?
Well, first, I felt really good about it. I mean, because that was a huge thing to win something that had never been accomplished in the entire history of the United States. But it was a very hollow victory because it was based on fraud. I mean, the judge in my case never asked to see the doctor's letters. The two doctors wrote the sex change letters because my transition to female was a failure. So that was bailing all of us out. Mm-hmm. Except the judge never even asked to see the letters until after the court case was over and the media started blowing up. And then to make matters worse, the lawyer told me before the court case that the judge has a transgender child. I came to realize that the judge really wasn't validating me as probably as much as she was her kid. So I carried that big secret around, and it just a lot of it just continued to eat at me throughout time.
So tell me now, in the 2 minutes we have left, and I have so many other questions I want to ask you. I find your story fascinating and courageous, but part of your motivation to embrace your God-given masculinity now, where does it come from? Now you are on a journey that you ought to always have been on. You are in a safe place. You are gaining that peace. Where does this motivation come from, to be honest and open now?
I'm cleaning up my mistakes. I feel terrible that I have led people's children into believing that they can assume a fake identity to fix their problems. I've cost the taxpayers millions of dollars with this. This has been a horrible thing to my family. I've hung myself with it. And this whole thing now is basically about coming clean and confessing that it was all wrong.
Jamie, your story's been incredible. I encourage our listeners to go to thedailysignal.com and find Jamie Shoup's op-ed that recently was published just a few days ago on March 10th. He has been my excellent guest today, Jamie. We will have you back. God bless you. Godspeed to you and all you do. May your message go far. You have been listening to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I have been your host, Sarah Perry. Thank you so much for sitting in with us on this American Heroes edition. Follow Tony Perkins at T Perkins and go to our website, TonyPerkins.com, for more information on today's show. We'll see you next time on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.